Dog Works Radio Network presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to our Day 13 coverage of the 2017 Iditarod here on Mushing Radio. You can hear us on 89.7 FM in the Matsu Valley on RadioFreePalmer.org, on their own app, Radio Free Palmer, on iTunes, and you can also find all of our previous episodes dating back all the way to 2010 on iTunes as well. Just search for Dog Works Radio. And you can find us all over social media searching for Dog Works Radio. You can find our co-host Alex Stein on Twitter at Coldfoot Films. And you can find me at Robert Forto. And calling in from California is our co-host Alex. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great, Robert. As people may or may not know, and if you don't know, let us break the news to you. We have all of the teams are now in Nome, so there is no one left out on the trail. Cindy Abbott came in as the Red Lantern winner just about an hour ago, a little over an hour ago as we're taping this. And this is her second Red Lantern win. So we have 64 teams that finished this year's Iditarod. And, you know, even at the back of the pack, this has been a very, very fast race.
It has been. I know I read somewhere real quick before we went on air, she was a day and, 6 hours faster than her previous time. Is that right?
Yeah, I believe it's something along that amount. And it's kind of an astonishing thing.
It is, and she was only 40 minutes behind the team in front of her, so that's great news as well. You know, we've talked about it over and over again on this show that typically the back of the Packers, and in particular the Red Lantern, are just so far behind, sometimes days behind the lead group, and possibly even many hours behind the person in front of him or her. But these guys in particular were traveling relatively together, and that's sort of how it was the whole race for the whole group, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I just realized that right before we went on the air, I gave you a wrong piece of information. So let me correct that. Cindy Abbott actually came in, finished about 12 minutes behind the next to last musher, which was Peter Reuter. Paul Hansen, Alan Eichens, and Peter Reuter were all more or less traveling pretty much in a little mini pack from White Mountain down to Nome. Cindy Abbott left White Mountain about 40 minutes after Peter and then was making up a little bit of time, wound up finishing 12 minutes behind him for the Red Lantern. And, you know, Cindy is someone that we've had as a guest on this show before, a just fantastic, wonderful person who is running a team out of Vern Halter's Dream a Dream Kennels. And she is now the second person to win two Red Lanterns. Ellen Halverson has also won two.
So Cindy finished in 12 days, 2 hours, 57 minutes, 31 seconds, and the winner finished in 8 days, 3 hours, 40 minutes, and 13 seconds. That was Mitch Seavey. And we've talked about it the whole race, how fast it has been. I remember not too long ago, Alex, like in probably this decade, I guess, that the winner was coming in at that 12-day mark, and now we have everybody off the trail in that same amount of time. That is just really cooking it to me. I can only imagine how much better the teams are trained, much how more prepared the mushers are, how much better the trail is when you can get that many folks up and down a 1,000-mile trail in under 2 weeks.
Right. And not only that, but the spread between the first and last team of, you know, less than or just about 96 hours, 4 days, is also pretty remarkable. I remember in the past that there were sometimes the spread between the winner and the Red Lantern would be a week or close to a week. So this is, it's really compressed. And, you know, as we mentioned many times during this year's coverage, the trail has just been extremely fast this year, and it's been fast for the front runners, for the middle of the pack, and even for the back of the packers.
Yes, it has for sure. So what story do you have? You know, we remarked yesterday how, you know, it's difficult to find stories about a lot of these guys and gals as the race progresses. You know, people tend to move on. But it hasn't been a real big story year, has it, Alex?
No, it hasn't. And I'll jump back to that in a second. The one thing that I did notice since from yesterday to today is that we've seen in the back of the pack a number of people taking rests where you ordinarily wouldn't expect them, or taking longer than normal rests. So a lot of people who were coming in from White Mountain yesterday were reporting that there were a lot of winds, and in some cases there were near whiteout conditions. So Zoya Denure, who finished early this morning, got into safety and actually spent 7 hours and 34 minutes in safety before she went on to Nome. And as longtime fans may know, traditionally, people get into safety. You're only 22 miles from the finish. They put on their bib. Maybe they do one or two little things, but it's not at all unusual for people to spend, you know, under 5 minutes in safety. And part of that is that a lot of them just want their dogs to be able to finish. They don't want to risk that the dogs might decide that they've had it and stop. So I'm not sure exactly what was happening with Zoya, but we have heard that she suffers from the same nerve disease that Lance Mackey suffers from, which makes it very, very difficult in cold weather. Since there was a lot of wind last night, it's possible that she was having difficulties with her hands and decided that she would just wait there in the checkpoint until it got a little bit warmer, or until the wind picked up. And then at the back of the pack, the what the teacher on the trail is called the final four, Paul Hansen, Alan Eichens, Peter Reuter, and Cindy Abbott, they all spent more than 8 hours in White Mountain. And there's a mandatory 8-hour rest, but traditionally people will leave at exactly 8 hours, or sometimes 8 hours and a couple minutes. Paul, Alan, and Peter Reuter all spent well over 9 hours in White Mountain, and Cindy was there for nearly 11. So again, I'm not exactly sure what the weather conditions were there, but I'm thinking that they might have all decided that they would wait for a little bit of a break in the weather before they went forward.
Right. You had mentioned how quickly most people get in and out of safety. That is almost a superstition, isn't it, Alex, to get in there and get out as quickly as possible, because you do not want your team to, you know, to think, wow, this is another break. We're going to be here for a while. I can take a nap. I can relax here. They just want to rock and roll. And, you know, when you talk about White Mountain at just being at 77 miles, that's often not enough distance where a person would have to camp. Typically, they would make that in one long run or two relatively short runs, broken up, you know, in half, and then maybe just a short feeding or something on the trail, but not a full-fledged camp where you would, you know, bed down your dogs with straw and all of that. So that's probably a pretty good indication of why those back of the packers could stay back a little bit longer. They were already in a comfortable position in terms of that competition rule that they have, where they must remain competitive. So if they travel as you said, the final four pack, they were confident that they could rest longer and not worry about, you know, somebody scooping them up behind them. And I think that was a great strategy to have. And then again, it may have been part of the race plan all along. Of course, we are never privy to that. That's usually a secret between the mushers and their handlers. And, you know, it very well could have been that that Cindy and her mentor and partner, Vern Halter, said, okay, when you get to White Mountain, I want you to rest 10, 11 hours. When you get to safety, you know, take 45 minutes or whatever's happening, you know, and break it up as they go. And they stick to that plan throughout the race. So that could have been a possibility as well.
Absolutely. And, you know, I was thinking at first that when Cindy took that nearly 11-hour break in White Mountain, that might be an indication that there was perhaps something a little bit off with her team. Maybe dogs needed a little bit more rest. And I was thinking that might indicate that she would be slower coming in from White Mountain to Nome. But I was looking at the tracker for a lot of this morning and early afternoon, and she was going significantly faster every time I looked at it than the other three in the final four. So they were all going between, you know, 8 and 9 miles per hour generally. You know, there's some hills and ups and downs, so sometimes faster, sometimes a little bit slower. Cindy seemed to be going between 9.5 and 10 miles per hour for most of that that trip from White Mountain. So whatever it was that she was doing, the dog certainly benefited from getting that extra bit of rest and really just seemed to be raring to go by the time she got back out on the trail.
Of course, her team was chasing the teams in front of her. I think you had mentioned that she left about 40 minutes behind the next person on the trail, and she caught up to that person was only 12 minutes behind at the finish. And 12 minutes in dog mushing is less than 2 miles, and that's going at 6 miles an hour. So I'm sure she could see those teams in front of her just about the whole way, especially in the you know, the straight on stretches where, you know, you can see for several miles, because there's not much up there. For folks that don't know much about the terrain of Nome, there's not a tree in sight, is there? I know that they have the Nome National Forest there on the Bering Sea ice. Is that right?
Right. Yeah. It's really kind of sparse, especially as you get in closer and closer to Nome. And a lot of mushers have talked about how it can be really kind of shocking when they start in Fairbanks or in Willow, and there's a ton of people there, and there are people at the checkpoints and other dogs at the checkpoints. But once you get towards the end of the race, generally you're in places where there just aren't a lot of people around. There certainly aren't as many dogs around, and things are getting more spread out. Teams are more spread out as you get towards the end of the race. And then as you're coming into Nome, it's really kind of I don't want to say desolate, but it's kind of an empty, secluded place. And then you come up off the ice and come onto Front Street, and suddenly there are dozens or hundreds or sometimes thousands of people out on the street. And that can be a bit of a culture shock, both for the mushers and the dogs, who've been used to running in seclusion or virtual seclusion for hundreds and hundreds of miles.
And tell our listeners about that Nome National Forest. What is that up there in that little village?
Right. So the Nome National Forest is basically Christmas trees from the residents of Nome that after Christmas in January or whenever one would get rid of their Christmas trees are put out onto the frozen sea ice in the Bering Sea. And they now have a sign that's erected that says Nome National Forest, and then in parentheses, seasonal. So it is it's a tradition that is a bit of a joke, but also something that everyone who's in Nome who doesn't live in Nome, everyone who's in Nome goes out to see it and to look at it, and it's one of these wonderful kind of traditions that has grown up around the Iditarod.
Good. Just for a second, Alex, you had mentioned sort of coming back to reality. I read a blog post from Mike Santos's kennel. I believe it's called Doggone It. Blog on doggoneit.com. It's his blog that he writes about. And he talks about in his latest post just about how quickly everything comes back into focus. You know, as soon as you hit Front Street there, the world literally surrounds you. All of a sudden, the logistics of getting home, all of a sudden your email, your taxes are due in a couple of weeks to the IRS, your cell phone is beeping, your friends and family are there welcoming, surrounding you, and hugging you after 1,000 miles on the trail where you were relatively alone. It just happens very quickly in just a matter of minutes. Often as soon as you pull on the Front Street there from the sea ice, a pilot car will pull in front of you and lead you down the street there. I saw a video, I guess it was yesterday or day before, of Didi Genro being led into the arch there by a pilot car. And I can just imagine how quickly everything just comes back in your face and back into focus. And, you know, that it's got to be bittersweet. All of a sudden, all that seclusion, all of that work, all of those dreams are suddenly flashing behind you, and the reality is catching up so quickly.
Yeah, and, you know, I've heard a number of mushers talk about there is, I don't know if it's a tradition, but a lot of mushers will make a point of stopping when they are 5 or 6 miles outside of Nome and just knowing that this is kind of their last chance for a while to just be alone with the dog. So they'll stop, they will snack the dogs one final time before they get in, and they'll just take the opportunity to go down the line and speak to and be with and thank each and every one of their dogs for taking them on this journey. And, you know, a lot of people have said it's very important for me to do this while I'm still alone with my dogs, because, you know, 20 minutes later or an hour later, there's tons of people around. And
right.
It's a little bit confusing for the dogs, and it's a bit of culture shock from being out in the wilderness to suddenly being, you know, surrounded by hundreds or thousands of people.
Right. Yeah, I can only imagine. I'm looking forward to that day for myself. I always told myself, Alex, that I was not going to go to Nome unless it was on the back of a dog team. And I had the chance to go last year for a few days and check out the sight and sounds and all of that and that little village. And what an experience. It was fun to be up there, even though I was not on the back of a dog team. It was just so much fun to experience that. And I know we're going to talk a little bit about that tomorrow. Is that right?
Yeah. We're going to talk a little bit about what it's like in Nome and what it is like for the mushers, how the town of Nome gets ready for the mushers, what happens when they come in. So we'll spend a little bit of time talking about that. I wanted to get back to something you said before, just briefly. When we were talking right before air, I was saying there hasn't really been one huge, overwhelming story of this Iditarod. And in past years, we've had one story that's really dominated. And it seems like this year things have been relatively smooth, so that there hasn't been one story that has completely dominated Iditarod in the way that it has in the past, I think, 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, a lot of times those stories are the ones that are more sensational than the others. You know, it's typical news how that sensationalism sells. But, you know, what I would like to do next year, Alex, if you and I are on, I would like to take the time to talk more about the dogs on the trail. I know we always talk about the mushers. We do our musher profile every evening. But I would bet on all of these guys' Facebook pages and websites and blogs, I bet that they talk a lot about their dogs as well. I know Dallas talks a lot about his dog, his one of his lead dogs, Reef. I know Cindy Abbott talks a lot about her dogs from over at Vern Halter's place. So maybe next year we can spend some time each show talking about a dog each night as well. What do you think?
I think that sounds fantastic. I think that sounds really, really, really good. We, you know, we emphasize on this show, and all of the mushers emphasize as well, that it really is about the dogs. And, you know, with 1,100 or 1,200 dogs competing, it gets a little bit hard to keep track of them all, but I think that sounds
right.
Like a wonderful idea.
All right, so since it is a relatively slow news day, so to speak, and we have everybody off the trail and everybody is enjoying some relaxing time in Nome before the banquet tomorrow, let's talk about our featured musher of the evening. It's a veteran musher. He's been around a long time. Ken Anderson, what do you have to say about Ken?
Well, you know, it's really – Ken Anderson is a really interesting musher, and there are – a number of mushers who kind of fall into this same category. He is someone who has run the race a lot. He generally does not get much press. He's one of these people who is a very well-respected musher, who has done extremely well in the past in Iditarod, and yet somehow he's never quite broken into that that elite group of people who get talked about and interviewed and written about a lot. And, you know, that group includes people like the Seavies and Jeff King and certainly Lance Mackey, and then other mushers who don't finish quite as high, like maybe, or at least recently not quite as high, like Didi Genro. There's a lot of people who tend to get a lot of press. And then there's mushers like Ken Anderson, who is a very solid, really good musher who has performed extremely well over a long time in Iditarod, and yet he doesn't seem to be someone who just gets a lot of attention for some reason. So Ken is 44. He's born in Minnesota. He had parents who were recreational mushers, so he's been around dogs and dog sledding most of his life. He said his parents had Malamutes when he was growing up and that he'd always wanted to drive a sled, and his parents would do these sort of recreational expeditions on the back of sleds. And he convinced his dad when he was just a kid to let him drive the sled when they were on one of these expeditions. And he promptly crashed it into a tree and shattered the brush bow, which is the curved piece in front of most sleds. He says that he had always wanted to run the Iditarod since he was in third grade, and his father gave him a book on it, and a book on Iditarod, and he decided that this would be his goal for something that he'd want to do later in life. He worked as a handler for a variety of mushers and says that his real mentor was a musher named Arlie Jorgensen, who ran a lot of mid-distance races in the lower 48, never ran Iditarod, and also for many, many years ran a tour business giving sled dog tours in Minnesota. He's run all kinds of races, and he's one of these mushers who has made it a point to not just focus on mid-distance and long-distance races, but also consistently has run sprint races. He went to the University of Minnesota, moved to Alaska to study biology at the University of Alaska at Fairbanks. He is married to Gwen Holdman, who is also an Iditarod veteran, and they have three kids, including 8-year-old twins. Gwen is an Arctic Fulbright Scholar, which is a program that has 17 scholars from 7 different countries who collaborate on issues about the changing Arctic region. And last year in 2016, she spent 3 months in Iceland doing research on renewable energy. And Ken and the entire family got to be there for a while. And he says he went to all of the thermal pools in Reykjavik and got to see a lot of the country of Iceland. For people who don't know, Iceland is right on the right on the intersection of the European and American tectonic plates. So there's a lot of geothermal energy in Iceland, and they have been able to capture that and use a lot of that in terms for all of their power needs in Iceland. And she is an engineer who is studying how to bring these sort of renewable energy projects to the Arctic in Alaska. They live with their family outside of Fairbanks, and they have a property that is off the electrical grid, and it's powered largely by solar and wind power, including several power innovations that his wife Gwen came up with. And he is people who have been following Iditarod this year may recognize Ken Anderson as one of the people who picked up Linwood Fiedler when he fell off his sled and his dog team came into the checkpoint without him. Longtime fans might remember that last year Ken got a 2-hour penalty because at the beginning he was running with 3 dogs abreast, which was a violation of one of the rules, although he admitted that he hadn't read the rules in detail and didn't realize that he was violating that rule. But he took a 2-hour penalty in Ruby for that. He has run the Iditarod now and completed the Iditarod 17 times. His first
wow.
race was in 1999. He finished 26th. He took a couple of years off. And in the last 16 years, had 16 top 20 finishes, including this year in 17th. He had 6 top 10s, finished 4th in 2008 and 2010. He races all kinds of not only sprint races but mid-distance races, and says that he has tried to pick mid-distance races where he feels that he has a reasonable chance of doing well to make some more money. In 2015, when he finished the Iditarod, his then 6-year-old son was a gnome and ran down the chute to greet him, jumped on the runners, and rode the last 50 feet with his dad until he came into the Burled Arch. One of the things that I've always loved about Iditarod is that they let things like that happen. Mark Nordman made a statement the other night that he said that with regard to this whole vet book controversy, he said that the Iditarod is a race run on merit, not on technicalities. And if you wanted to be very technical, you should not allow anyone to get on the back of the runners, anyone who's not a musher to get on the runners with someone before they finish. And yet I've seen a number of times where family members or kids will come and ride in the last 20 or 30 feet, and that doesn't make a difference and doesn't harm anyone. So I am always really happy to see something like that happen, and I think it just personalizes and humanizes the race and the racers. So that's always a wonderful thing to see. Ken has said that this is his last Iditarod, that he wants to be able to devote more attention to his family and wants to be able to not have this race making requiring such a huge commitment in terms of time, emotional energy, and finances. He's young. He's only 44, so you know, I could definitely see him coming back and running this race again in 10 or 15 or 20 years. But he said that for now, he feels it's time to move on. He's going to start a sled dog tour business and says that he wants to actually start making a little bit of money out of mushing. He's got his own kennel that has, I believe, about 50 dogs in it right now. And he has lifetime earnings, including this year from Iditarod, of close to $500,000. And while that sounds like a lot, and certainly if someone were to hand you or me $500,000 tomorrow, we would be very, very happy about this. That's representing more than 20 years of investing in the dogs and investing in running races, feeding the dogs, vet bills, shipping out equipment and drop bags, and all of that. So when you consider that he is most likely spending anywhere between $50,000 and $100,000 a year on keeping that kennel going, having winnings over 20 years of $500,000 is, you know, doesn't even begin to cover it. So he's been a really steady and admirable and I think very well liked musher for all the time that I've been following Iditarod seriously. And while it is sad that he won't be competing, at least for the next while, it's certainly understandable. He's given a lot to the sport, and we wish him all the best in what he does next.
A couple of thoughts on Ken. He has been on this show before. If you go to dogworksradio.com and at the top of the page type in Ken Anderson, his interview with me from a few years ago will pop up. It was by far one of my favorite interviews I have done with one of the Iditarod mushers. He's such a great guy, Alex, as you mentioned. And a couple of other things. I am so impressed by that resume here on Iditarod.com, his career summary. 6 top 10 finishes. How impressive is that? And almost every one of those finishes is right around the same time, that crucial 9-day mark. I would say well more than half of them are right there in that 9-day mark, with a couple of them in the 10-day mark. His rookie run was in 12 days. That is a very impressive rookie run back in 1999, when the race was much slower than it is today. We've talked about that a lot, including today. And then in 2009 was his second slowest finish. He finished in 14th place at 11 days and 1 hour. So with that, he is a very consistent musher over a term, as you mentioned, from 1999 to 2016. Also, Ken is an innovator in terms of equipment and mushing. He has lots of videos on his YouTube page that I assume are on his kennel page or on his Facebook page. He was one of the first mushers to develop and use one of the cabooses to carry sleds or to carry dogs and to carry other gear. And he was a vocal proponent of carrying dog, or adversary, I guess it is, of carrying dogs in those cabooses when the rule was changed last year. And what I found most interesting in the last couple of years, he has had a handler, somebody coming up to qualify for Iditarod or to help him out at his kennel. And each time, these guys and gals have kept very detailed journals of their time with Ken, and they are such amazing reads. I don't know if you had a chance to read some of those over the years, Alex, but what a bunch of storytellers that these guys are. I think the last one that he had up was a young lady from Europe, and she wrote an absolutely wonderful journal working with Ken about her trials and tribulations of being on the dog team and all the crashes and scratches and smiles along the way. Did you get a chance to read through some of those over the years?
I have. I haven't read all of them, but there, as you said, it's just some wonderful, wonderful stuff, and really gives you a taste of what that lifestyle is like.
Right. Last thing on Ken, he does live just outside of Fairbanks in the Fox, Alaska area, very close to Lance Mackey's kennel, and several other mushers live right there in that area, sort of a hotbed of mushing just north of Fairbanks there off the highway as you're heading up towards the Hall Road. The Hall Road has been made famous by the Ice Road Truckers show on the Discovery Channel, so he lives just north of there, but just close enough into town where he's not in the middle of nowhere. He's still relatively close to all of the givings and trappings of a city, so he can he can come and go as he needs to and not have to live pretty much in the middle of nowhere, even though you said he lives off the grid, but he lives pretty comfortably off the grid with his wife having all the knowledge with solar and wind power and all of that. So yeah, Ken is a colorful character, and I'm glad that we're able to profile him. And I did not know about his son riding in on the runners. That's a cool part of the story there, and I agree with you. Technicalities are not or should not be part of the Iditarod at that juncture. I mean, heck, unless it's a neck and neck Dick Mackey type deal with Rick Swenson back in the day. Let the boy run on the runners. I think that's a cool way to remember your dad's legacy on the Iditarod and everything that goes with it.
Yeah, and one more thing that I just wanted to mention about Ken, and this I think holds true with all of the mushers that we've talked about, and I think if you dig down, it probably holds true of almost every musher who competes in Iditarod, is you never really know what's going to have an impact on people. And so we've heard about a lot of mushers who go out and do presentations about the race and presentations at schools, and people get inspired by reading books about the Iditarod or by hearing people on the radio or on TV talking about running dogs. And it seems like almost every musher that I've talked to who has been doing this for a while, they recognize how important that is and how important it is to either be doing these sort of talks and presentations or be working with handlers and inspiring them to keep diaries and write down their experiences, because someday someone is going to have been inspired by what one of Ken's handlers wrote and is going to go on and run Iditarod, or someone is going to be inspired by one of the many school presentations that people like Hugh Neff does. And I think a lot of times we do these things because we think that we should do them, but then we're never really sure if they have any direct effect on anyone. And it's hard to know because the direct effects aren't often clear for many, many years. But all of these things are important, and all of these things that that Ken Anderson and most other mushers that I'm aware of do have these ripple effects that will, help set the stage for the next generation of mushers. And that's a very important thing to do that I'm not sure people always appreciate.
Right. I agree with you. And, those teachers on the trail, there's one every year, but almost all of those guys and gals got started by, following the Iditarod in their classrooms, especially in the elementary schools. And the next thing that they know, they get just so hooked on the Iditarod that they come up every year for the teachers' conferences, and some of them have eventually become mushers and had hopes of running Iditarod one day. So yeah, it is a very wide-reaching sport, and it's just too bad it's not a sport that is easily covered on television. I know that they've tried it before on Discovery Channel and other outdoor type channels, but typically it's just a recap. It's not like most sports where it's contained and it's over in 3 hours, and even the Indy 500 is over in an afternoon. Even though they're going 500 miles, it's over in an afternoon, whereas this is well over a week or two, and that's tough to cover. So, Alex, we are definitely out of the time. We are recording now. The streaming is over. We're going to do our last show tomorrow, and we're going to talk about one of the Barrington twins, one that we have not covered here on the show, Anna Barrington. Is that right?
Yes. So we'll talk about Anna tomorrow. We'll talk a little bit about Gnome, and we'll recap some of the things that really stood out to both of us for this year's race. So we'll kind of be wrapping everything up tomorrow, just in time for them having the finishers banquet in Nome.
Excellent, for sure. Alex, do you want to do 4 o'clock Alaska time, or do you want to do a little later, closer to the banquet?
You know, I'm good for any time that works for you.
Do 6 o'clock Alaska time. That's a little closer to the banquet. We can get our stories together. We can talk about the awards and all that. And that way we are a little closer to everybody glued to the internet as the banquet takes place.
Perfect.
All right, Alex. So on behalf of my co-host, Mr. Alex Stein, we will see you guys tomorrow. Thank you. Goodbye.